Hello and welcome back to the RHS Gardening Podcast. I'm Guy Barter, Chief Horticulturist, based here at RHS Garden Wisley in Surrey. As regular listeners will know, in our podcast we bring you seasonal advice and tips from RHS experts throughout the gardening year. Coming up in this spring edition, we visit the RHS Community Allotment Project. We find out how RHS experts are helping develop a network of grow your own expertise to help increase the numbers of people growing their own fruit and vegetables across the UK. RHS advisors answer some of your spring gardening questions and, as always, the latest news on RHS gardening events across the UK. But first, let's hear about some of the key jobs you can be tackling in your garden this May.
Hello there, my name's Douglas Mackay. I'm part of the propagation team at RHS Garden Wisley. And we're here to talk about things going on in May. Well, as you might be able to hear, we've got the rotavator going on in the background. Our next bedding display is about to go in, so we're just tidying up ready for that. But the garden's looking lovely this time of year. Battleston Hill, with all the rhododendrons and the azaleas, are looking lovely. All that spring fragrant flowers all out, and the birds are singing, and it's lovely weather. In propagation, we're just finishing the tail end of our seed sowing. The last of our things like melons and squashes and that for the vegetable garden we're just sowing now. But probably the most important thing at the moment is that the weather's really getting much hotter at the moment. A lot of the things you've probably got in your greenhouse at the moment, we can start moving those outside. They'll be absolutely fine, so everything's going to be perfectly safe, and it'll give you more space for next round of cuttings, softwood cuttings, seed sowing that you want to do come the summer. It's a good idea to keep an eye on pricking out in your glasshouse. Things at this time of year, when there's so many other things going on outside and you want to plant things and digging, things like seed sowing gets missed because it's surprising how quickly you can prick something out. Well, it's after you've sown your seed and it's all coming up and you've got those kind of cotyledons appearing and you've just starting to see those two true leaves coming through as well. So your cotyledons are your seed leaves, so they'll come up first and they're designed to give the rest of the plant as much energy and light from the initial burst, just to get its roots established, the initial burst of energy, and then it will start producing its actual leaves, the leaves that it will stay with for the rest of its life, and they'll look more like the actual plant, whereas the seed leaves just tend to be kind of just round and rather boring looking, really. But you don't want the seedlings to get too big. As soon as you can handle them, really, is the best time. As soon as you can just tease them out of the tray gently, prise them apart, something like a pea stick or a dibber works really well at getting away from the roots. And then into something not too big, maybe something like a 9 centimetre pot is probably the biggest you want to be putting something into, because it doesn't need too much compost around it until it's got rooted a bit more. It helps with things like damping off. Especially when you're pricking out things like cauliflowers, you can bury them as deep as you like. Really, you only want just the top of the leaves appearing. So you've got all that stem in between. Often it has quite a leggy stem before the leaves form apart. So get that up to there, and then when you're watering and things, it's not likely to fall over and just sit and rot on the compost. Damping off is a disease that especially young seedlings get. It's caused by a fungal organism called Pythium. And it's something you can't really treat against, but the best means of our defence is just good hygiene, clean trays. It's just keeping everything as sterile as possible. So you're not introducing things, so not putting things like seedlings into garden soil, for example. Use a nice clean compost or other growing media, and then you haven't got that extra battle of all those pathogens, because larger plants can handle that kind of medley of bacteria you get in the soil, but young seedlings won't. But also just keeping good airflow around the greenhouse, keeping it vented during the day to keep that airflow moving in and out the greenhouse, stopping that kind of humid, muggy atmosphere that you can sometimes get, especially in warmer weather like this. And be careful with the watering. If you overwater, often the seedling tends to just get suffocated and there's not as much oxygen in the compost. And that's when things like other diseases like Pythium are more likely to come in.
Remember, you can find more information on all aspects of gardening techniques on the advice pages of the RHS website. Go to rhs.org.uk/advice. I'm Guy Barter, and you're listening to the RHS Gardening Podcast. Now, spring is one of the busiest times in the Advisory Centre, as the phone lines, email inbox and our traditional post bag are all filled with inquiries about gardening problems. On this podcast each month, members of the RHS Gardening Advice Team are here to tackle some of the queries they've received recently. Members of the RHS can get advice on any gardening problem for free all through the year from our expert team. Questions can be submitted by phone, post or email or in person at any of our RHS flower shows. So let's join my colleagues as they try to answer some inquiries they've received recently.
I'm Jenny Bowden and I'm one of the horticultural advisors.
My name's Anna Platoni and I'm an entomologist.
My name's Rob Sterling and I'm one of the advisors.
An M. Page from London has written in and says, for the last 3 years I've tried growing rainbow chard in small pots of compost and straight into the ground, but I've had no success and nothing at all. What might I be doing wrong and what's a fail-safe method for growing this gorgeous vegetable?
I grow a lot of vegetables in small modules or pots or cell trays because then I can keep an eye on them and water them carefully, get them to a decent size before putting them out into the garden. And I know I've got full rows then as well, so I don't get any gaps. Well, hopefully if the slugs and snails don't get to them after I've put them in. But I usually start them off in March, the chard. Late March would be fine. That's about the earliest you can do it. You can put them in a greenhouse or in a very cool porch, something like that, in multi-purpose compost. And really, there shouldn't be any major problems with it. Just keep them well watered. You can sow direct, but they are very vulnerable to slug and snail attack. Guy, can you think of any ideas why this person might be having a few problems getting them going?
Well, it's very odd because rainbow chard seed is usually pretty reliable, but a few ideas that may be worth looking into. One is it may be sowing too early and the seeds are too cold. They're very hardy, but they won't do very well if sown before April, really. But again, you can sow some in July to overwinter and for autumn use when the soil should be plenty warm. It's possible that sowing them too deep might be involved because each seed is a capsule that contains several tiny seeds. So sow them really shallow, perhaps half the width of your finger, and firm them in and try watering the soil before sowing. Moist soil is important because the rainbow chard are a member of the beetroot family, and these seeds tend to have an inhibitor of germination that can be washed out. So if they sit in dry soil, the inhibitor won't be washed out and the seed won't germinate. So sow them in moist soil and don't let the soil dry out until they emerge. So I can only suggest trying again. The seed is cheap after all. It shouldn't be too much of a problem, but so I think that you've just had bad luck so far, and there's every chance that more sowings will be successful in future.
Dennis Knowles writes in and he asks about Clematis armandii. He says, I read that this is the time of year to prune clematis, such as armandii. My plant is 2 years old. I've never pruned it before. How do I do this without damaging the plant? Rob, what do you think?
I think if the plant is just 2 years old, I would prune it very minimally, if at all. The plant does grow quite vigorously once it's established, and it can be trimmed to shape after flowering, but I certainly wouldn't prune it back hard in the way that you would perhaps one of the Vitacella clematis, which you can prune back to just about a foot off the ground in February. These are plants which wouldn't tolerate that kind of regular pruning, and you probably end up losing it. So if the plant is looking a little untidy, probably just light pruning is all that's required. And I would say that probably is the kind of regime that should be taken going forward until the plant perhaps does become quite large, when it will take some renovation once it's really established. But that shouldn't really be done more than, say, every 5 years or so.
I think Rob's hit the nail on the head there. Although it's a good idea to prune evergreen plants in spring just before growth starts, Clematis armandii has got a bad reputation for resenting being pruned, so I think keeping the pruning to an absolute minimum is advisable. One thing you can do is with this young plant, presumably it hasn't grown very much, and you're going to bend down the shoots to quite low down so you get a good spreading growth from ground level. At some stage, either now or in future years, the opportunity arises to do what's called layering. Layering is a technical term for when you take a stem, give it a slight twist to wound it, and then bury the wounded part under a pile of soil. You do that at this time of year in late spring and early summer, and by the autumn it's rooted. So you've got a spare plant, and then if you do your heavy renovation pruning and the plant does not come back from this pruning, at least you've got a replacement already without having to buy another plant.
The next email is from Jane Nelson of Cardiff, and she said, I'd like to have more scent in the garden and was thinking about planting a summer flowering jasmine. Can you recommend me some interesting varieties to try, please? Are there any coloured varieties that have a strong scent as well?
Jenny? There's lots of lovely jasmines to choose from. If you live in the shelter, in a sheltered part of the country, then you can actually plant the jasmine that you get in the garden centres in the wintertime, which is jasmine polyanthem. That needs a little bit more warmth than some of the others. It's got beautiful white scented flowers. Its foliage is probably semi-evergreen. If it gets a bit cold, it'll drop some of its foliage. But in some of central London or in the middle of cities, you'll probably find it keeps hold of its foliage. And it's fast growing and vigorous and will cover a wall or a shed quite happily. And will probably need to be thinned each year. It's very enthusiastic and very highly scented. It has little pink buds, and you normally buy it, you can buy it as an outdoor plant in the garden centres, but in the winter you see it around a hoop normally. That's how you'll buy that one. There's one called Cornish Cream, which is a little bit hardy. I think that's an officinale type. And obviously it's a creamy coloured one.
There is a golden leaved one which is really interesting called Fiona Sunrise.
Oh, that's right.
And it comes out almost orange and then sort of fades to yellow. That's the foliage rather than the flower, so that's a particularly interesting one
make a nice contrast with some purple foliage or dark green. But they're all very, very highly scented. So there's
a nice one called Stephanensi as well, a hybrid, which is pink. The new foliage of that is actually pink as well. So, you know, it comes out, changing its foliage over time, which is very interesting.
They're quite widely available
they
as
are,
well.
Yeah, all of those are.
Nice sunny spot, and there you are.
Yeah.
And then Carter has emailed in of a question about their daffodils. They say, my daffodils flowered very poorly this year. Is there any way I can rejuvenate them, or should I just dig them up and buy new bulbs for next year? One of the first things in these cases is to decide whether a pest called the narcissus fly is involved. Anna, what should they look for to detect the presence of a narcissus fly?
So if you dig up the bulbs and take a look, you're looking out for larvae, maggot larvae, and there are two types of narcissus fly, one which feeds, is a secondary pest and feeds after the damage done by the first one. So if you decide which one you have based on their size.
Unless you're a trained entomologist, you can't really tell them apart from other flies, but they're usually wombling their way around your narcissus borders in late summer. And when the plants die back, they lay their eggs at the top of the hole left by the leaves, and they go down and do evil things in the bulbs, maggots, as Anna said. But what they tend to do is they tend to eat out the growing tip. So if you've got narcissus fly, you find not only do you have no flowers, but you also have lots of very fine grassy foliage. And under those circumstances, it's probably better to replace the bulbs because they've been so badly injured. It'll take some years before they come up to flowering size. And to deter the fly, run your rake over the bed or the planting, wherever, as soon as the foliage dies back, to fill in the holes. There's no pesticides, unfortunately. So once you've found or ruled out the presence of narcissus fly, what else could you do to get them to flower again, Rob?
Well, it's one of the things to think about is actually how long the bulbs have actually been planted. If they were only planted, say, a year or so ago, the reason they're not flowering this year, apart from possibly the narcissus fly, is perhaps they were planted in too shady a spot. which would have caused the bulbs to receive too little light, and so consequently they didn't build themselves up sufficiently in order to produce flowers for this year. Another thing to think about is how deeply the bulbs were planted. If they were planted, you know, with their noses of the bulb, the top of the bulb, virtually at the surface of the soil, then this is too shallow. They need to be planted about 2.5 times the depth of the bulb. So if the bulb is 5 centimetres or 2 inches high, then it needs to be planted around 6.5 centimetres or 7 centimetres deep, which is about 2.5 inches, 3 inches. And that will enable them to produce the flowers for next year.
Another reason why they might not be flowering too happily is because they've got too dry in the summer. Actually, too wet in the winter may cause them to rot off, but being too dry in the summer, they really, really dislike. So if you've got daffodils growing next to a Leylandii hedge, for example, where the hedge has drunk all the water, then that perhaps isn't the best place to plant the daffodils. However, if you do move them, then you can turn the situation around. And if they get enough moisture during the summer, they will start to flower again. So there's no need to actually throw those daffodil bulbs away. That's probably one of the main reasons why they don't flower. And I think some species, or not necessarily species, some cultivars are more susceptible to not flowering if they get a little bit dry. They're a little bit more finicky than others.
And if you are going to move them, just to add, it's probably a good idea to wait until the foliage just begins to go yellow before digging them up, because that is an indication that the bulb's growth cycle is finished, and so you can sort of be pretty sure that it's reached its maximum size before you lift it. If you lift it too early, there is a risk that it would actually be underdeveloped, and with the root disturbance that could prevent it from building the bulb up to its optimum size.
And too late, you don't know where they are.
And too late, you don't know where they are, absolutely. Fiona Gordon from Colchester emails in and says, I have 3 large viburnum bushes in my front garden. Last year they were ravaged by what a neighbour thought were viburnum beetle. How can I prevent them from returning and doing the same again this year? How do you spot viburnum beetle and their eggs and larvae? Anyway, I suppose you get lots of questions on this one, being a popular shrub.
Yeah, this is a very common question. And viburnum beetle, it's quite likely that is what has caused the problem. They cause a lacing effect on the leaves, which can be quite noticeable, and the leaves can sort of brown due to this defoliation, and also produce quite a pungent smell as well, maybe a bit later in the summer. Unfortunately, there's not a great deal you can do. Depending on the size of your viburnum plant, you could spray. When would you say is the best time to spray, Guy, against viburnum beetle?
Well, you usually start to see the little tiny larvae about the size of a pinhead round about late April. So as soon as you see them, that's the time to treat, because the bigger they get, the more difficult they are to kill.
Yeah, so looking out for damage really, and as soon as you can see the damage, then perhaps spraying. But if the viburnum is too big to get good coverage on the undersides of the leaves, then really it's going to have to be something you're going to have to tolerate, I'm afraid, some damage.
But luckily, it's only there's just a couple of the viburnums that are susceptible to it. So it's Viburnum tinus, which is the one that flowers in the winter through to early spring with lovely white flowers. And the other one is Viburnum opulus, which is the big round balls, Opulus roseum, that one's called. But there's plenty of other viburnums to choose from that luckily don't get affected by the viburnum beetle.
And have wonderful scent as well.
Barry Trim from Derby asks about cucumbers. What's a good variety to grow outdoors? Can I train them up a fence? Has a small garden, so he'd like to be able to use as much vertical space as he can to grow the vegetables this year.
Well, outdoor cucumbers are actually very easy to grow. The further north you get, the more difficult. But I think there's good success should be had in Derby. The one that has our award of garden merit is called Market Moor, which is a traditional British ridge cucumber type. But they're quite spiky, and you really have to peel them before you can eat them, unlike supermarket cucumbers that are grown in greenhouses. However, Japanese cucumbers, of which Tokyo Slicer is an excellent example, have got a much less spiky skin, and they can be consumed in the same way as a greenhouse cucumber, and they're equally easy to grow as Market Moor. And if you like pickled cucumbers, there's lots of gherkins. Modern ones are F1 hybrids, and they form fruits without fertilisation, which we call parthenocarpic. Mochas is one that is widely offered. So you sow the seed in April or May, plant out, and then sometimes, if your cropping goes well, it's worth making a second sowing in July for some late cucumbers. And yes, you most certainly can train them up a fence or a wigwam or a stick, whatever suits your purpose. And they're an excellent way of making use of vertical space.
Oh, we've got a question here from Rose Demare in Essex, who says, I'd like to introduce some summer colour into my small garden. It's a terrace, it's south-facing, with two long raised bed borders, which are currently empty. Can you suggest some perennials that are easy to care for and will bring colour in the summer months, please? Well, if it's sunny, there's such a lot of things you can choose. Rob, where should we start?
I think I'd like to start on the daisy family. You know, they're really good doers, very easy to grow, usually come back each year. Some of the best plants to use would be the Rudbeckias, I think, which are usually in a sort of a yellow, often having a raised central area, which is where the pollen is. They're very striking plants, really architectural. Flowers sort of in the late summer and last pretty much through to early autumn. The Echinaceas are another daisy family, often called the cone flower, because of the raised central area where the pollen is. They come in a variety of colours. They've become extremely popular, and they come in a variety of colours, from white through to magenta, and recently there are some even sunset colours on the petals, which are proving to be quite popular as well. Earlier in the season, Anthemis is a really good lower growing daisy, literally covered in flowers. And that can range from white through to cream and yellow, and even into magenta.
I definitely have some penstemons in there, because they come with such a wide range of colours. Whites, reds, purples, even towards the blues. And salvias as well, because there's a salvia for every height that you require, starting at about 15 centimetres going up to 60 centimetres, which is 2 foot, maybe even more actually, up to 3 foot, so around the 90 centimetre mark. They're all in the blue indigo colour range. The salvias that I've got in mind, for example, one called Caradonna, and a shorter one is May Night. So they're quite long flowering, and even when the original flower spike starts to fade, they're still quite architectural to look at. They have a slight sort of reddish tint as the flowers fade, that you're left with the sort of sepals, and they're very ornamental. And then there's the classics like phlox, and Veronicastrum is a very nice one. So it contrasts very nicely with the daisy flowers. It's nice to have a mixture of flower forms, so that you've got the daisy shapes, and then you've got spires as well, and perhaps even sort of round ball shape. So things like Echinops, which are quite a vivid blue with silver foliage. So it's all about contrast, really. And luckily, all the things that we've spoken about are very appealing to insects, aren't they, Anna?
Yeah, all of those are absolutely great for pollinators, such as honeybees and butterflies. So they're a great way to attract some more wildlife to your garden.
The RHS Advice Team. RHS members also get free entry to all four RHS gardens, plus the opportunity to buy priority tickets to RHS flower shows and events. You can also find out more about the benefits of becoming a member on our website, rhs.org.uk/join. Here are some of the attractions and events coming up in the next few weeks. If you've ever been impressed by the spectacular streamside plantings at Harlow Carr and wondered how to achieve something similar in your own garden, then why not join us for a guided walk and workshop on the 6th of June? Booking is essential and discounted places are available for RHS members. If you're longing to grow and eat your own garden produce, then join us at Hyde Hall on the 14th of May for a practical workshop, Starting from Scratch, which will show you how to raise plants from seed, plus planting techniques and aftercare for a wide range of fruit and vegetables. RHS members £40, non-members £50. Find out what you can do to attract and help bees in your garden this year at RHS Garden Rosemore. This free event runs in the Plant Centre on both afternoons of the weekend of the 28th to the 29th of May. Join us at Wisley on the 3rd of June for growing berries, currants and soft fruits. Learn how to get the taste of summer in your garden from strawberries, blueberries, raspberries and more. This session will cover different soft fruits and their care, planting, soils, siting, training, pruning and maintenance. Booking is essential and discounted places are available for RHS members. Full details of all events and more are on our website. The number of people becoming interested in growing fruit and vegetables in the UK continues to increase year after year. There are so many benefits of growing your own. The taste of freshly picked crops, the satisfaction of watching them ripen, control over what chemicals are used in cultivation, financial benefits, and the pleasure of serving a meal you've produced from plot to plate. One of the schemes the RHS have set up to help more people learn to grow fruit and vegetables is the Community Allotment Programme. Now in its second year, this gives successful applicants of all ages and backgrounds a chance to learn horticultural techniques from RHS experts. Students are given monthly tutorials, mentoring and a plot here in the garden at Wisley to apply and practice their skills, spending a year growing veg in a community allotment. We spoke to course coordinator Amy Adams and some of this year's community allotmenteers to find out more about the training programme.
Hello, I'm Amy Adams. I am the Courses and Workshops Coordinator at RHS Garden Wisley. The Community Allotment Project is now entering into its second year at RHS Wisley. So we began in 2015 with a group of 12 community allotmenteers who we recruited from the local community, who each have something that they are either already contributing or would like to give back to their local community. So for example, we have some retired teachers, we have some people who already work with children and want to continue to share their knowledge with children. We have some people who might foster children already and just be helping one or two individuals on a more one-to-one basis, but each person that is either doing something great or wants to give something great back to the community and that has got no experience of growing vegetables. So they are coming for a season's growing on an allotment plot within the garden, tutored by our RHS experts once a month on masterclasses, and then every week in question and answer sessions, basically to learn how to grow vegetables. So when the allotmenteers apply to the project, they might mention in their application that they want to go to the school that they might have previously worked with or where their children attend, and they will explain the way that they want to go and work back there to share the knowledge that they gain from the project here. It's like a chain of sharing knowledge, so it begins at Wisley with our experts sharing their expertise and knowledge to others that want to then go and pass it on afterwards. Last year's group of community allotmenteers were very successful in the vegetables that they grew, some crops more than others. Runner beans, they had coming out of their ears. The potatoes, they were just absolutely delighted with. They said they tasted delicious and they couldn't believe how many they dug up out of the ground. Courgettes, again, they had an enormous number of courgettes. Sweet corn that some people, their sweet corn was got at by badgers, unfortunately, but the people who managed to evade the badgers were very pleased with their sweet corn as well, which was such a shame because the badgers waited until that very last moment to get there. But we have improved our fencing and the badgers will not get the sweet corn this year.
My name's Kate Bradford. I live in Hazelmere. I very recently took semi-retirement, which is why the timing of this has been absolutely wonderful, because I've got time to come down midweek and do all the things that life of full-time work doesn't allow you to do. And I was particularly interested because I'm a really keen flower and shrub gardener, but a complete veg novice. So the chance to actually learn and garden in a place like Wisley itself is just a real, real treat. So I was delighted when I saw the ad and applied and got the place.
I'm Stephen Bewes. I'm a GP, and I've always had an interest in gardening, but thus far not any kind of guidance in gardening. So I just kind of muddled my way through. And this was an opportunity to gain some experience from professionals about guidance in increasing yields of vegetable growing and perhaps growing some things that I'd not grown before.
Well, we have a long list. We're all sharing the same list, but it's completely up to us what proportions we grow veg in. I think there are about 14 or 15.
Yeah, that's right, 14 varieties. The 15th is our wild card, where we're given free rein to try and grow a crop of our choosing. Mine is coriander, which I thought was good for many reasons. Firstly, the leaf is nice. Flowers too, but also then the seeds, hopefully, at the end of the season.
And I've chosen rhubarb chard because I absolutely adore anything that's like spinach, chard or whatever. Never actually grown rhubarb chard before. And I've chosen it because it has these glorious pink stems and then the green leaf. Mm. So it's absolutely delicious. Will hopefully look fabulous and give a bit of colour contrast in the allotment. And it's one of those crops that you cut and it comes again and again and again.
Yes.
So it sort of produces, it's got a high, very high yield, which is good too. So hopefully it will keep me going through the summer.
Do you think you can actually taste the difference between spinach and that?
I will tell you at the end of the year. We can all have a little blind taste test when we come and do barbecues down here and eat our produce together.
Jim, who's the chap who runs this, you know, will take us for a masterclass at the beginning of each session, once each month. And it's just little tips that he gives you, you know. So I guess because I've tried to grow vegetables myself before, I have a good understanding of what kind of works and what doesn't. But when you hear someone like Jim somehow succinctly condense down 40 years of growing experience into a sentence or two, you just think, oh, yes, that makes sense. Yeah.
And it's also the opportunity to ask questions. I mean, mm-hmm. we're just quizzing him the whole time. So you're sort of learning and then you're just testing out things that you've heard, things that have gone wrong at home. It's just a wonderful way to pack in a huge amount of information and actually see things being demonstrated in front of your eyes as well, because it's easier, you know, things go in if you actually see somebody showing you how to plant something. Or we've been doing wigwam tying this morning and none of us, I think, are quite up to speed on our different types of knots because it's been a while since we did those. But it really is brought to life actually seeing an expert there on his demo plot showing us how to do things.
Quite right.
Applications for the Community Allotment Project 2017 will open in September of this year, and information will be on the website, and the application opening will coincide with the Wisley Flower Show, so it will be at the beginning of September, and we will be promoting what we have achieved this year and sharing the successes of this year's allotmenteers.
You can find more information about the RHS Community Allotment Programme and how to apply for a place on next year's course at rhs.org.uk/Wisley Allotments. So that's all we have time for in this edition. We'll be back in a fortnight when we go behind the scenes at this year's RHS Chelsea Flower Show. Until then, remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @_RHS. For now, from me, Guy Barter, and all the RHS Gardening Podcast team, goodbye.